Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, the psychology of happiness. Research shows that much of happiness is under personal control. We'll discuss the psychological factors that contribute to happiness with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
So crazy time. We decided this topic, everybody could use a little happiness right now because it's sort of crazy, chaotic times that we're in. And there are many people feeling fearful, angry, anxious, helpless, and not only just because of a political divide, but the climate crisis, food insecurity, affordable housing. It just seems there's so much going on in our world right now that is so depressing. We thought maybe a little happiness would be a good thing. Jenny, I know you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah. Well, my first thought is just that I would feel irresponsible if I didn't comment that since January, we are having another mental health crisis where my colleagues who are not retired, which is most of them, are having once again their offices flooded with people who are overwhelmed with, just as you said, fear and helplessness, but also some being triggered by past traumas, feeling like they're coming back down on them again. And so we do need to find some way to have a little respite. I have never in my lifetime had a president have such direct negative for me impact on so many people who I know and love. And it's a lot. And so we need to find a way to not melt down, not freeze, not stop our lives, but to try and find little moments of happiness within that.
Yeah. Anybody want to add anything? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just what you're pointing out in general is that you do have agency in terms of finding happiness. Or finding joy. There is, by the way, it helps to frame this, there is a difference between happiness and joy. Happiness is a more of a surface feeling, emotional state. It comes from when something good happens, you're happy about it. You had a good meal, you're happy about it. You see your relatives again that you like, you're happy about it. And it's temporary. As I said, it's reactive to an event. Whereas joy is something different, a little bit different, in that it's much deeper. It persists in spite of what the events might be. It's a sense of it comes from within, really, and it can persist during tough times. It's spiritual. It's soul. Sometimes religion is involved. Doesn't have to be, but it. It's more profound. If you've been a parent, you know that sense. And on during the drudgery of raising children, there are periods of joy when you look in their eyes, you see them sleeping at night or something. It's profound.
Yeah.
Just to frame our talk a little bit, that happiness and joy are not the same things. But the point is, you do have agency. You're not just a victim. You have the bad things happening, like you just described, Jenny, and impacting you. But what you have control over is the way that impacts you. You have control over your reaction, in other words. You don't have control of the circumstances, but you have control over your reaction.
I would agree.
I was just going to say, I think there are people listening going, but I feel so helpless. How do I do that? You know, I mean, I think the helpless part of it, when you're looking at just, and it's being so overwhelmed by so many different things coming at you in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. That's hard. But Mark, you just said something that made me think, you know, you said, when you look at your child asleep and you feel that joy, I would say the same thing goes for a pet, for people who don't have children, that same, you know, feeling when you're, and pets, especially dogs. I'm sorry, cat people. I mean, maybe it's for cats too, but dogs, it's like, no matter what you do, that dog is always happy to see you when you come home. You know, you come up in the morning, the tail is going, and just even if that's just a few brief moments of joy right there every day.
Sure. No, it's deep. Yeah. It's a connection that's joyful. Yeah. And that's the word for it.
You dog
But
people, though, cats also bring tremendous joy.
I'm sure
they
they do, just in a
do.
different
As do
way.
No, they don't.
rabbits and
Oh,
no, they
rabbits.
don't.
Pets in general, right? One of the things I was thinking about with this is like, you hear this, can money buy you happiness? And I thought this was interesting. Some research says money boosts happiness up to a point, but studies show diminishing returns after that threshold. So it can alleviate poverty, improve basic needs, but its influence over overall happiness decreases once those needs are met. That makes sense, right? It does it go to maybe sense of purpose? I mean, isn't it something we always ask ourselves? Why, what's our purpose? Why are we here?
Yeah, so to address sort of the issue of the sense of helplessness right now as the stock market goes down and then it settles and it goes down and then it settles as a recent retiree, this is terrifying. You can do small things that are acting in your own interest. So you can write letters, you can go on marches, you can also do other things like become involved in your local community where you actually have more of a voice and more of an ability to have an impact. I know that, for example, the League of Women Voters, nonpartisan, is always looking for members who are willing to join and contribute in whatever way they're able to. And so I think that that again is, acting. There's ways that you can act. So I always think of something like a, because I'm dark, I always go to like concentration camps or something like that. But you can even within that kind of context be kind to other people. There's always something you can do that improves the environment around you, something small that improves it. And that can bring a sense of purpose and a little bit of sense of agency.
Since you mentioned
But
that,
that
oh, go ahead, Mark. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the environment around you, having some impact on that and getting involved in that. But how about the environment in your head? The self-talk part of dealing with this crazy environment, crazy and harmful and dangerous environment. What's your self-talk? I think that's a useful thing for people to pay attention to. Because if your self-talk, which a lot of people will have, is, oh my God, this is so terrible. It's everything's going to be different. Life is going to be terrible. If that's your self-talk, you're going to feel it. You're going to experience it that way.
It's almost like that finding the silver lining even in the worst situations. I know I've said this before. My grandmother would say, "Nothing so bad it couldn't be worse." So find the silver lining, right? But I'm a big believer in that whole, positive reframing, positive thinking. I think it makes a huge difference, at least in my own life, and even in small things. I've told this story before too, but I remember years ago being on a ski team after work, and you're looking down at that icy hill, and you're going, "Oh man, this is icy." And we had a guy on the weather guy on our ski team who was like, "Get that ice before it gets," and he would give us this huge pep talk at the top of the hill to reframe how we're thinking about this run we're about to do, and we would all do great. When he wasn't there with us, not so much. So really, I mean, it's almost like that where you have a big speech coming up and you don't like to speak in public and you sort of think about, you picture yourself doing well. And it sounds so corny, but it does work.
I especially if you have a cheerleader. I remember one time I went climbing with a friend of mine who is now deceased, but rock climbing, I had never been before. I got about halfway up and I was like, I can't go any further. And she was down there the whole time saying, "Come on, Jenny, you can do it. I know you can do it. I know you can do it." And I made it to the top, and I have never forgotten that moment
Nor have you been rock climbing again since
nor have I been rock climbing ever again. That is accurate, Jonathan. But not because I didn't enjoy it, just because I don't have the equipment and there are other things I would rather be doing.
Jonathan, I
But
bet. I
it really speaks to how, if even when I literally felt I could not go any further, I
right.
felt I was done. Nope, you can keep going.
Yeah, you can open. And I would say, Jonathan, I'm sure you have patients who you have these conversations with, right? That maybe they start going down this path of negativity. How do you help them reframe that to something more positive?
Well, I think that just the acknowledging the existence of these negative tapes, which people have in their head, is very powerful because most people don't realize until you identify it that that's actually going on in their head. I think, I see Mark shaking his head. This is it's just amazing how once you identify the existence of that tape, which we all have it to varying degrees, whether they're positive, negative, the reality is that we it's human to kind of repetitively reinforce whatever your beliefs of the moment may be. And of course, for many of the people who I'm seeing, there's obviously a problem or they wouldn't be seeing me. So the tapes tend to be negative. They tend to be self-reinforcing. I refer a lot of people to therapists for cognitive behavioral therapy because a CBT is really the kind of most, it's seemingly the most kind of efficient. I mean, there are many different strategies you can use, but CBT is kind of acknowledged as the most powerful first choice for strategies for interrupting those tapes, for identifying them. M meditation also, I talk a lot with patients about the power of meditation. You know, that it's free, it's portable, it's safe. There are no weight gain, no dry mouth, no side effects. It's simple. It only requires patience and persistence, which of course is true for almost any goal that we might have. And I talk a lot about that. I think I do think that I think meditation, personally, I believe that meditation and time in nature are two of the most effective, powerful tools in feeling well.
Ah, completely agree with that.
Me too.
And you know, there's a reason, a good reason, for why we have these tapes. Our brains, I've said it before, our brains are prediction machines, and we perceive the present according to the lenses of the past, the lenses of the past having been formed by our past experience. And that's just the way every human being is. You perceive, and part and the feeling about the perception, about the facts of the perception, say, are based on past experience, and that way emotions can become dominant. And all you do is, or you know, you're a slave to the emotions from the past, slave to the emotions of what you've predicted unconsciously. It's all unconscious. It's not. But it helps to make it conscious, actually, just what you're saying about pointing out the tapes and knowing the tapes. This is how we perceive the world. It's the way our mammal brains have been evolved, and you can't do anything about that. That's human nature.
Go ahead, Jenny, because
There's a book called The Artist's Way, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with. I have read it. Most of it I did not find very helpful, but morning writing, morning getting up at the first thing in the morning and just writing whatever comes to your mind, no judgment. That's an easy way to begin to make those unconscious thoughts conscious and to start noticing them. And then once you start noticing them, it becomes not easy, but easier to go, no, I'm not going to think like that. I'm going to think this other way. And so,
Well, I mean, that goes back to we did a whole program on this, on being thankful and keeping, you know, because sometimes you forget, right? You're so focused on maybe what you don't have or what you haven't accomplished that you forget to stop and take a moment to look at what you do have and what you have accomplished. And once you start, you know, maybe jotting that down, or as Jenny say in the morning, you know, just writing this stuff down, you go, whoa, you know, I sometimes, you know, my husband will complain about something. I'll be like, are you kidding me? Look, we have a house, we have a good family. And it's like, it really sometimes it just takes a little recognition of what you have that makes you a little more thankful than, you know, what you don't have.
Right. So if you also, if you notice what it is that you, if once you start noticing what that tape is, so maybe it's, I don't have things that other people have, and you can notice what you have. Or maybe it's, I haven't accomplished anything in my life. And then you can go back and look at your CV and maybe and be like, oh gosh, I did. Or if you have a CV, or look at your children. Or, you know, I think that all of these things we're talking about, I have, and maybe you guys have also had this experience at one time or another, somebody come in and say, I've tried that, that doesn't work for me. I think you have to try all these different things and find out what works for you and what doesn't. And so, one of the big suggestions for having a more content and happy and healthy life is to put your phone down much more often. Maybe have a electronic Sabbath. You can choose whatever day you want and not look at your electronics for that day. That might be impossible for some people, but for others, that might make a huge difference in their
And
lives.
that a small that I was just thinking made me think of Mary LeClaire wrote a book about that. She normally writes novels, but she did this book of her. She did, I think it was one day a week, if I remember, where she didn't speak. It was kind of like, just sort of a meditation. And the impact that it had on her life is, I mean, it's a great book. It's been a while since I read it, but what an interesting experiment. I mean, obviously not everybody has the luxury to be able to do something like that, but even something small, Jenny, as you're saying, is putting the phone down for a day, or well, nobody has their electronics at dinner, or just these small little things that kind of force you to interact with each other, right?
And the first step that a lot of people, the first thing that comes to their mind with these suggestions is that won't work for me. I can't do that. And then if you can engage them in really being mindful, why? What is the block there? And that's a consistent, repetitive tape. That won't work for me. And it might not, but it doesn't matter. You're predicting that it works for me.
And
Some people, that's their take.
And I think give it a try, right? I'm just thinking of the whole meditation thing. When I first started that, it was really, really hard because my brain is just going everywhere. All of maybe I have a little ADHD, I don't know, but it's like it was really hard to just kind of focus on nothing, right? Or just focus on breathing or whatever it was. It gets easier as you do it, but I can see where people go, oh, I can't do that. My brain would never stop thinking, right? So yeah, it's a practice, right?
Absolutely.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. We'd love to hear what you're doing to give yourself a little respite or some happy moments. Our email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. And you're listening to The Point. We're talking about the psychology of happiness this morning, how we're taking a respite, finding some happy moments in this time of chaos and depressing news. With us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam. Love to hear what you're doing to give yourself a little respite. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. As we're talking about this, even like putting the phones down or kind of talking to each other, interpersonal connections, not wealth, are the strongest predictors of long-term happiness. And that makes sense, Mark, even going back to times we talked about, we're tribal, right? I mean, that's really important to us.
We had to be to live, because being in the tribe protected us from the dangerous world, which was really dangerous. Our day-to-day experience is not like it used to be, where there were, you were hunting and gathering, and you didn't know in the morning whether you'd be eating that day or not. It was tough living, and that's how our brain was formed. That's how where our brain got wired, so to speak. There's a book called that we came across in looking at this topic called The Power of Fun. Catherine Price is the author. At any rate, she defines what real fun is as opposed to fake fun. Fake fun might be scrolling TikTok. That's fake. That would be fake fun because real fun consists of three elements. And wouldn't be bad to think back of the last week or month, your own experience, when you've had these three elements together. The three elements are playfulness, a sense of play. There's not a deadline or responsibility involved, or so it's just play. And there's connection is number two. Connection with another person, not with a electronic device. And flow, a sense of flow. The athletes talk about this in terms of their abilities to get into the flow, and they're not even thinking. about what the play is. They're just automatically flowing and having real fun. If if the other two elements are there. So that's not a bad exercise to do, I think, is to see, am I really having fun with
It's
this
a real
activity?
fun, yeah.
So now I would just, the only thing I would add to that is some people are 100% stressed out by other people, and you can't. I would disagree with the, I have fun when I am able to get into the flow state with painting, for example, or drawing. That for me is play, and it's really fun, and it's not, and I might be, I mean, for me, because I'm not terrified of other people, I'm thinking about my friends who are doing the same thing, and we exchange the pictures to show each other and that sort of thing. But there is alone play too, as long as you feel safe. You have to have that feeling of safety.
Got an email from Eleanor in West Tisbury who says, I've always been a happy person, but why? My parents insisted that I was born happy. Is that actually biologically and or emotionally possible? Or is it just a reaction to one's parents or earliest caregivers? Obviously, I'm not happy in the face of tragedies, global or personal, but happiness has always been my baseline. Any research on this? That's such a good question.
That is a good question.
And there is
So,
research on it,
there's
Jonathan.
actually there actually are is a team of people who are quite famous for doing research ex on exactly this topic. Stella Chess and Alexander Thomas are the two people who have authored several really powerful studies and have written books. I actually learned about that them from their work from my. From my dad, who was a pediatrician, but so what they studied humans, children from the newborn nursery and followed them up through adolescence, looking at temperament and personality traits to try to understand the nature versus nurture dichotomy, and what they found was that you could identify, I think, a seven different personality traits right in the newborn nursery, and that those seem to carry through right into adulthood. So I can give the person who's asking the name of the book that I had, but until somebody failed to return it. Let's see, which let's see, it's.
While you're looking that up, I'll just say I also like I attribute some of my sort of positivity. My mother, as since the day I can remember, she always like you can do anything, whether it's a career or whatever. She was always very positive in you can do anything you put your mind to, and she reinforced that so much throughout my life. She was again my biggest cheerleader, right? That I believed her. And I think that's an important for a lot of kids, right? I mean, how many people have self-esteem problems and they think, and they really are standing in their own way because they think they can't do it when they probably can, right?
Yeah, that goes right back to the rock climbing. So to be concise, it's both. It's nature and nurture.
Nature and for sure. Did you find the name of the book?
Well, Temperament and Behavior Disorders in Children by Alexander Thomas and Stella Chess is one of the books. It was first published in 68. The book that I actually had was well, actually that could have been, yeah, I think that actually was it. But if the listeners look up Stella Chess and Alexander Thomas, they'll come to several books that are all pretty much on the same subject. And it really was interesting that they were able to identify very specific traits that are apparent. An example of that being, openness to new stimuli versus backing away from anything that's new and different. That could be judged on
A
facial
fear.
expression and behavior, right? Or even in the newborn nursery.
And so that means that is really a function of brain wiring at that time before there's been much in the way of nurture and before there's language too, that there are different personalities before we have language to express and show our personalities. So it definitely is a biological factor, the inheritance, the genes, and like Jenny says, it's both. It's the nurture, the environment, how safe it is, how loving it is, how encouraging it is for you as an individual versus fitting a role that the family wants and put you in.
We got another email from a listener who says, a girlfriend of over 40 years that has experienced all the ups and downs of life along with me has a way of keeping positive. At night, before she falls asleep, she says aloud the things she considered blessings of the day. That speaks to, Jenny, sort of what you say you're doing in the morning, right, that she's doing at night. It's a good idea.
Yeah. I do it
at night as well. Every night I write down one good thing that happened that day, even if it's like I took a shower and it felt good, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Hey, it's something positive. You know, and I think sometimes I think setting realistic goals is also probably another good tip because, you know, you think people go, I'd be happy if... Right. I'd be happy if I find the right mate. I'll be happy if I have this particular job. I'll be happy. And that's not necessarily true. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's that anticipation of the goal. The anticipation sometimes is a better feeling than actual getting to the goal. Once you're there, it's like, OK, now what?
Yeah, I mean, I find, and again, this does not work for everybody, but I find that to-do lists are fantastic for my mental health. So that at the end of the day, I can look back and say, oh, I got those things done. And then, you know, at night, I can set my to-do list for the next day and I can add to it throughout the day. But every time I check something off, I get a little like endorphin burst, you know? Oh, I did that.
Sense of accomplishment. Yeah. Also, you know, just thinking about that thing of keeping local, where we're feeling, a lot of people are feeling very helpless, as we mentioned. And Jenny, you sort of touched on this. When you can get involved somehow locally, and that doesn't have to be, you know, politics. It could be anything. It could be, you know, working with some nonprofit or whatever that's somehow helping in the local community. I would think that would make you feel pretty good, sense of accomplishment, right? Those are things where I guess it can give you a little bit, I don't know if it's a sense of power, empowering somehow, but at least you're making a difference, right?
Yeah, so it has all these different elements of it where you're working in concert with other people towards one goal. That's an endorphin burst. You are not being helpless. You are making a positive change and you're around other people. You know, just to give a quick plug for one local volunteer organization, Neighborhood Falmouth, you can sign up and do little tasks. Mostly they need people to drive people to medical appointments and things, not even medical, the gym or a hair appointment, but it's trying to help people age in place. Mm-hmm. And they have lots and lots of people signed up for their services, but they always need more volunteers. And you can do it once a month, or you can do it every day of the week or whatever. And you can, you know, help people with their bills or pick up their laundry for them. There's lots and lots of tasks. And it's, again, working in concert towards a common goal with a group of people, to make your world a little better.
Yeah. And there are so many nonprofits. Also, there's like volunteers in public schools. And I don't think we have it in every school system, but, you know, mentoring kids, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. I mean, there's so many different organizations locally that you could really make an impact on your community.
Massachusetts, it's known to have more volunteer opportunities than any other state.
I didn't know that. Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What are you doing to give yourself a little respite and add some happiness to your life? We'd love to hear from you more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the psychology of happiness with social worker Jenny Putnam, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'd love to hear from you. How are you dealing with these anxious times? How are you, giving yourself a respite? What are you doing to create some happy moments in your life? We all could use a little happiness. So if we can share some tips, we all have a few moments of happiness here and there. And it's interesting because there's a growing body of research that suggests that happiness can improve your physical health. Feelings of positivity and fulfillment seem to benefit cardiovascular health, the immune system, inflammation levels, blood pressure, among other things. It's even been linked to a longer lifespan as well as higher quality of life and well-being. That all makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. And this is again a personal story, but I think this is relevant that pretending to be okay is not the same as being right. Okay. Right. So last June, my dad actually had a heart attack and I was fine. I'm fine. I'm strong and I can take care of the whole family while this is going on. And then a week later, I got shingles.
Oh.
And I was on the couch for 3 weeks. In pain. And so, that was an example of pretending to be fine and having a very quick, pretty severe physical reaction to not dealing with the stress that I was feeling. Mm-hmm. So I don't recommend pretending that you're fine.
Yeah. But then when you said, ask yourself, but why were you pretending to be fine? You didn't want to burden anybody else in the family, right?
Yeah, it's curious. I mean, my family is very, when tragedy happens, we just come together really fast. The even people who don't get along, we all show up, right? Hmm. So it was not on me to do that. I'm not really clear. I think I was doing it for my dad, not for for anybody other than my dad, that this was about him, not about me.
Yeah.
But I'm not really sure, which is not a great thing to admit as a psychotherapist, but...
I just wanted to add that I don't think this has been brought up, but a very extensive study, a 40 year study of what contributes to longevity is that the number one influence or factor that when you control for all other variables correlates with longevity is the degree to which an individual has meaningful connections among other people.
Mm-hmm.
So a network of family, friends, a sense of basically boiling it down to a sense of community. And this isn't about, acquaintances. This is about, having people in your life that you really trust and feel comfortable with, long-term connections, the sort of people who have friendships that have persisted for decades, mm-hmm. people who still have friendships from, elementary school or college for that matter, that when you, as I say, when you control for everything else, having that network of meaningful relationships is the single most powerful determinant of longevity. And not that the goal is necessary to live as long as possible, but it is to live as healthy as possible for as long as possible.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I have one more element to introduce here, and that is time. Be mindful of time. There's this book called 4,000 Weeks. Well, it turns out that 4,000 weeks is the number of weeks that the average person has to live. It's 4,000 weeks. And when you look at it like that, geez, what am I doing with this last week? That was one of them that fell into the
bucket. Only 4,000?
That just made me more stressed out, Mark.
Get used to being mortal. Accept that. That's a tough one. But we all are. So 4,000 weeks, you need to accept that limit. We often feel that we have to do more. If only we did this, finished this task, got to, did something, we're going to be okay. No, look at the time, look at the present, be in the present, and be aware of you're not going to be here forever. So a lot of these things that we feel we have to feel compelled to do or compelled to be are meaningless because nothing lasts. We're all
When you
temporary.
achieve, we all end up in the same place.
Being in the
That's
moment,
right.
mindfulness. Here we are back to
That's
mindfulness
right.
again, right? All right, Janet is giving us a call from Martha's Vineyard. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have a book to recommend all of
Sure.
you. It's called The Last Human Job. It's a brand new book, The Work of Connecting in a Disconnected World. The author's name is Alison Pugh. And it is right, you guys are getting the right ideas that she has. She's a professor of sociology and the chair of the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at the University of Virginia. And she's written quite a few books and has been in the New Yorker, New York Times, and New Republic. You guys have got to read this.
Okay.
Can you say that again, the title and name of the author?
The Last Human Job is the title of the book. The author's name is Alison Pugh, spelled PUGH.
All right.
Thank you.
Janet, as
Really,
always, thank
really
you.
good. It's right on, I'll tell you.
Okay, we'll
Well,
check that out. Thank you so much for that suggestion. Appreciate that. I was saying I just kind of looked.
can I suggest one other book that's
Yeah,
sort of
sure.
related?
Yeah, go
It's
ahead.
a new one by Chris Hayes called Siren's Call,
Oh,
that
yeah.
about the our addiction to the phone. And he talks about sitting with his daughter in his lap, and she's looking lovingly up at him, and he's trying desperately not to look at his phone. And how, here's this moment, this ultimate moment of connection, and he's drawn away from it by this siren's call.
That sounds interesting. Yeah, I know.
It's
And
really interesting. It's a really good book.
right, and it's funny. I mean, kids see it right from an early age, right? I mean, they call you out on it, and I mean, we just need to listen to them if we're going to expect them to follow the same advice. There's a something called the Big Joy Project, and this some research came out in November 2023. It's a collaboration between UC Berkeley and some other research institutions, and they studied 70,000 participants, more than 70,000, in more than 200 countries. And what they found was people who commit daily what they call micro acts of joy experience about a 25% increase in emotional well-being over the course of the week. And I'm like, okay, what are these micro acts of joy? And they're simple things. It's the gratitude list that we talked about earlier, a journal, acts of kindness, meditation, or what they call positive reframing, which is that finding the silver lining. All of those are small things I think that all of us can do, right? It'd be interesting, especially if you are somebody who keeps lists or journals, to keep track of that, right? To see, like, how am I feeling at the end of this week? Is it different than the previous week? But so that's some ongoing research in that, how we can add a little bit of happiness more to our life. I'm wondering if we can just touch on too. We talked a little bit about positive psychology. I know this is sort of a new research area, but how do you help people reframe their thinking to, get into the habit of that? Because it is hard in the beginning.
One of the ways I've heard is a CBT technique. Jonathan, you may know more about this than I do, but where you take a piece of paper, you split it in half, you write your negative thought on the left side, and then on the right side, you write a response. So it might be, nobody loves me. And then you write, well, my husband loves me, or, well, my child loves me, or my cat or dog loves me, or I love me, or whatever. So that you're constantly putting the answer, and you just keep going until the voice that says nobody loves me quiets down. So the more you reinforce a positive pathway, the thicker that's going to get, and the thinner the negative pathway is going to be. So stop yourself and then think of something that contradicts it. So I might say, what's the antidote to that? What's the antidote?
And Jonathan, since you work with children, I'll bring this up. My grandson, he also has a very active mind at night. He has a hard time going to sleep. And I'm like, well, what are you thinking about? I'm thinking about tomorrow and what a disaster it's going to be. And I'm like, why do you think it's going to be a disaster, right? And he's just thinking about all the things that can go wrong in his day. And I'm like, how about all the things that can go right in your day? Is that the right approach? Am I taking the right approach here, Jonathan, saying let's look at some of the things that could be good in your day?
No, absolutely. I mean, and of course, I've met Jackson at the dinner, and he's certainly the best dressed child of his age. There's no question about that.
He was dapper.
I think that any child therapist would really enjoy working with him because he is very bright and clever. And you know, what you said is true, but of course, you probably get discounted to some degree because you're his custodial parent. Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, well, you're just saying that to cheer me up or whatever, you know. But for him to actually develop tools of his own that he can take ownership of so that he recognizes that the tape is playing, whether it's the anxiety about the coming day or whatever. And I think, you know, despite it, how old is Jackson?
10, he'll be 10 in another couple of weeks. Yeah.
He's 10 going on 18. Yeah. I mean, you know, or 22 or whatever.
30. But,
You know, he I mean, most kids his age could not really think about it in think about things in a psychological way, in my experience. Mm-hmm. But I think he could. The biggest challenge is going to be finding the right person, you know, for him to work with. And not that it's a long-term proposition, but it's just, you know, Jenny may be able to help because she knows the geographical territory.
We can talk about that.
Also, it would help if you just congratulated him for thinking about the future and what's going to happen. You're putting something in words that most people just kind of torture themselves about. It's just one thing that you can reframe it a little bit in a little bit different terms instead of trying to get him. You run the risk of having an argument with him, his predictions versus yours.
Yeah, right.
That's not going to get anybody anywhere.
Exactly. All right. So let's
say that those little things you say are going to last him through his lifetime, even if he rolls his eyes at you now. Yeah. He may reflect back on them later.
That's why I remember things both of my grandmothers would say to me. I still think of them to this day, and you know, when I was a kid. So yeah. So I think one of the things we've talked a lot about, and it seems true, especially in these times, that two things that can really help us: breathing and exercise. Those seem to be the remedies for just about anything that ails us, right?
And again, I would say that I'd say this over and over again, but you know, find the exercise. I don't even call it exercise anymore. I call it movement. Mm. Find the way of moving your body that works for you. So if it's a 10-minute walk every day, that's fine. You will see, if you do a 10-minute walk every day for 2 weeks, you will notice a change. You will notice a change. Mm-hmm. And so it does not have to be 4 hours in the gym. That, of course, is going to make you, well, not of course. If I do 4 hours in the gym, I am then laid out in bed for 2 weeks afterwards. So it really has to be what's right for you and your body.
Right.
That you do. And don't let anybody tell you differently.
Yeah. So movement. I like that movement. And then movement. Also, I mean, because people go, all right, I'm going to exercise. This usually happens in January. We haven't done anything for a long time. And people do like a little too much. So starting with that 10-minute walk is probably a good idea because, you know, we get to a certain age. It's like, oh, how did you, you know, throw your back out? I was tying my shoe, right? I mean, it's like, we have to be more careful.
I mean, I was an athlete and now I can stretch at night and take a 10-minute walk, and that's about it. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Mark, some thoughts on why is breathing and exercise so important? What's happening in our brains with that?
First off, you're creating a situation where you're getting some dopamine release. Dopamine being the quote unquote the pleasure chemical that happens directly. A lot of people will come into psychiatric care actually when they're running, say 5 miles a day, ceases to help them. So in other words, they've been self-treating themselves, especially people with ADD or ADHD do this. But it only goes so far. It's stress relieving. It's good for the heart. Endorphins, the hormone balance, it's just as good for everything in moderation,
right?
Like people were saying, you don't want to hurt yourself and then you can't do it. In moderation, yeah, it's it's the best medicine that we have in our toolbox, actually, for health promotion.
Yeah, and really. Just thinking back to the and knowing what you can no longer do that maybe you did really great in your 20s and 30s. Like, I was two seasons ago, I was skiing, downhill skiing, and I used to love to ski, but I have to say it was we don't get a lot of huge, big powder here. And it was right after a big snowstorm in New Hampshire. And I was coming down the hill and thinking, oh my gosh, I had forgotten how hard it is and how you really have to bend those knees and skiing in the powder. And I said, I see physical therapy in my future here, right? And and I haven't been downhill skiing since. I'm going to still do the cross country. I'll still do the snowshoe. But I feel like my days of, flying down the mountain are over because you can really get hurt.
I think it is. I like the expression "movement is medicine."
Yeah,
and it is absolutely true, but it's also true that as we get older and we get stiffer, that you can't just all of a sudden go from 0 to 100.
Right.
And I mean, I work out, like 5 hours a week: weightlifting, cardio, stretching, balance work. I'd have to be pretty much retired to do any more than I do now. But if I'm going to do something like, let's say, helping somebody move and lifting cartons to put in a truck, all of a sudden I feel like I'm completely out of shape because I'm using muscles I haven't been using in the gym. I don't lift heavy boxes at the gym and twist and turn. So we just have to be very humble about warming up and starting slow, but that shouldn't discourage people.
We just need to give you some heads up so you can do some workouts at the gym to help us move our boxes.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Just in case, Jenny, I'm busy that weekend.
Okay.
Just got a couple minutes left. I kind of want to circle back to where we started this because a lot of people are feeling that uncertainty and fear. And so just sort of what people should maybe keep in mind, because those are powerful emotions, right? And especially fear, and there's a lot of it right now. How people can, as you mentioned, we can't control a lot of what's happening. All we can control is how we react to it. But Mark, some thoughts on how we do that.
Being mindful of it and observing your reaction. We do have the capacity to observe us as a reactor. If you pay attention to that, is where you put your attention is what matters. Pay your attention to how you're reacting and even making a judgment about whether your reaction is called for in this moment. Mm-hmm. For instance, usually, and especially in this uncertain environment, you're talking about the future is uncertain. In fact, that's the way life is. The future is always uncertain. It's just that it's in our face now. And the things that we relied on to be certain, a competent government that's based on reason and critical thinking doesn't exist now. We can't rely on that. And okay, that's the way it is. It's a few more years of it. Eventually, even the people that put this man in office are going to wake up. They have to. So, at any rate, just be mindful of how you're reacting and try not to judge yourself for reacting this way. But you don't have to be swept up in it, swimming in it, overwhelmed with it. That's the point. You have some agency to put it in place and. Like we're talking about, direct your attention to something that is more meaningful to you.
All right. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Jenny Putnam, as always, thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.